Station number 1312, Mr. Cyril Mount.
Israel 8. We're talking about the period in the desert in July, after the Battle of Al Rashid. And basically, what happened next?
After the 2nd and 3rd of July, things seemed to stabilise. People were still in shock, really, that losing so many mates. And there was a general sort of air of gloom over the battery.
How many had you lost? Have you any idea?
I forgot what the percentage of the regiment was, but I should have remembered these details. I didn't know, and I've got an almost awful memory for figures and.
No facts. Matter. No.
It was a very large percentage of casualties. There were no. There seemed to be a dearth of familiar faces. There was a lot of new faces.
You got restocked up immediately then.
Reinforcements came up. Everything became much more stable, but it was different. And then we pulled back. We went in action at this point on the 20th of July, and John Evans Lawrence, battery captain, actually set up a pay parade. There was talk about a leave. Talk about people going back to Cairo. And there was a pay parade, which, looking back, it was so ridiculous. And made a rough table out of petrol cans and a blanket. And we were all sitting around, a great semicircle. And your number was called, and you went up, and you saluted, and you got your pay. And it was quite a lot of pay, because we hadn't been paid for ages. And way up in the sky, somebody noticed a tiny little silver speck bumming around. And the Beaufort boys banged away at it, I think they were short in range, the puffs were. But then he disappeared. No, he didn't. No, he was still hovering around like a bloody mosquito. And then there was a big black thing just way over towards the sea from where we were. And the next thing, another big black smoke bang, like a bloody oven door smoke. And we realised we'd been bracketed. This bastard had seen us, and these were 88 airbursts. And of course, Dirty Boy started frantically trying to dig in. Luckily, it was soft sand. And the next thing, they opened up full. And Little John, Evans Lawrence, was killed outright. And my mate, Bert, was screaming. He'd been hit in the stomach. And sort of scrambled over to him. And his whole stomach was hanging out on the sand. And he was trying to pull it back. And it was absolute fucking mayhem for half an hour or so. And it stopped, and stretcher bearers came up. So that was the second big.
Were you able to do anything for your friend?
No, just held him.
No, he died.
He died, yeah.
And this whole thing was interrupted the pay parade.
Oh, yes.
You were within 88 range and you were on pay parade.
Mm-hmm.
Did anyone get into trouble for that? Because that sounds like gross incompetence.
It was absolute bloody stupidity. But I mean, poor old John, little John. I don't suppose. I don't hold it against him. After all, he got killed, didn't he? But it seemed such a daft thing to do. See? But he was a regular. You see, a regular officer. Still polished his chin strap.
Were there many killed there?
I think there were more casual, wounded than killed. I don't remember now who was killed and who wasn't, but it was just a few more. Oh, some of the new lads were killed. But Bert Fox, I took a photograph of his grave when I went back last December.
Bert Fox was your friend.
Yeah, he's the one who was killed. Yeah.
How did that affect you? I mean, you've just gone through.
That really, I think, that upset me a lot. It made me even more scared too. to think, you know, the sort of things that can happen. You can be ripped open like that. Sorry. He'd been running when it happened, you know. If he'd laid down, if he'd dived down, it might not have happened.
Had you come under 88 fire before?
Yeah, but not airbursts. It was 88. There were groundbursts, but this is the first time I'd seen airbursts.
Mm. And they'd been spotted on by this plane you'd seen.
Yeah, just a tiny little silver speck. Yeah.
So that was the 20th. You were actually out of the line at that time.
We weren't in action at that time, no.
And what's the next thing you remember?
We went into fairly static position. I think we'd pulled back. I suppose they thought it was sufficiently far, but it wasn't sufficiently far. And then we dug a static position. This was August, and established two OPs up on the ridge.
The same ridge?
Rwaiza Ridge, yeah. We never left that area until we went forward to up the line to Tunis. And there was 0.63 at that end, which was a German OP, and there was 0.64 at this end, which was our OP, which was called Frank OP, after Frank Roberts, who was one of our officers who was killed. And then there was, forward of that, was Honey OP. And Honey OP was called Honey because there was an RHA Honey tank. Are we recording now? Yeah.
Sorry. Yes.
There's an RHA Honey tank which had been hit, and hit in such a way that it was impossible to get it open, and there were bodies inside, and it stank, and that was on the flat bit at the bottom of the rise. See, the ridge, although it's not just a continuous ridge, there are hollows in the ridge, there are flat bits, and then it goes up, and ROP was up a little gully that we'd made, and there was a hole in the ground that had been blasted out with the corrugated iron and sandbags on top. And from there, we were about a kilometre away from the German OP. We could actually watch them going for a crap. And we had a sort of mutual arrangement that, you know, we never shelled each other. It was funny for all those months, right up until October.
So you settled into a long period from August to October.
It was a static period, yeah, of just firing concentrations, firing on targets that we could see. 83-85 battery on the other side, and they directed a long pole with a chair on top, a stool on top, with guy ropes and a little metal ladder, which the Germans could see actually, but they couldn't hit it. But it must have been very scary sitting up there with a telephone.
Now, I'd like now to look at the sort of conditions of service and lifestyle during that period of static, fairly static, by Rwaiza Ridge. Can we start with your actual gun positions and where you were at B Echelon? Mm.
Yeah, the guns were dug in what was on the surface a patch of soft sand with a lot of camel scrub. But when you got down about 2 feet, you could actually cleave the sand. It was firmer, and you could dig quite easily. Very different from the gravelly. There were lots of gravelly patches which had rock underneath, usually. So these sandy bits were quite useful, and the guns were dug in there, and they had camel scrub interwoven with the camouflage nets, and they were very well camouflaged. They were about 2 or 3 feet down. So the result was they weren't casting any shadows. The wagon lines, on the other hand, which is where the gun tours and the other vehicles, 3-tonners and so on, and where the meals were cooked, was very vulnerable because it was very difficult. They weren't in a soft area, for one thing, and it was very difficult to dig in a 3-ton vehicle or a towing quad. The result was that even with the nets, these things were casting shadows, which were spotted very frequently by German spotter planes. At that time, we still didn't have anything like air superiority.
So, were you able to get them down at all, the trucks?
People were digging in. They obviously had to dig their own slit trenches first. But there was an attempt to dig in, but you know, we didn't know how long we were going to be. We did shift positions several times, but only within half a mile. Basically, we were in the same area. It was very difficult to dig big vehicles in. I mean, you could, in soft sand or earth, you could dig a vehicle pit. You could drive down into it. But
what about your own? Would you just have a slit trench?
No, my position. I was based when I wasn't at the OP, which was about every 2 days. We did a sort of stint at the one or two of the OPs. My home, if you like, at that time was in a slit trench, which was battery headquarters area, which is sort of in between the two troops of guns. Where we had the command post, which was in direct contact, line contact with the people who were operating the guns, the gun position officers. So my hole was made from, it was dug in this sort of slightly damp sand. Where the soft sand was, the 2 feet of soft sand on the top, I had old ammunition boxes filled with soft sand, and they sort of stopped the rest of it from blowing in and falling in. And then, like most of us, we scrounged. There was lots of wood around because the petrol cans, these flimsy petrol cans, came in packing cases, and we'd tear these apart and be a bit of a scramble for the planks. And gradually, we were able to roof over, putting these planks across the ammunition boxes. And then with bits of old tarpaulin or ground sheet or whatever you could find, it was a ground sheet in my case, yeah. You covered the whole roof of your hole, and then you stuck some camel scrub on it. And there's a picture of my hole actually in the War Museum here. I did, and the ground sheet sort of flapping down, covering the door, and that was it. And you left your gear there. Your blankets and your... I used to take my haversack everywhere with me because I had my sketchbook in that. It was very precious. I never let go of that. One time it did... I lost a lot of drawings. A truck caught fire, a 1,500-weight truck caught fire. It got a hit. And a lot of drawings I'd done in India and Iraq all went up in flames. So I haven't got any record of that period.
So that was where you lived?
And that was where I that was my base, if you like. And then about every 2 or 3 days, you'd do a 24-hour stint at the OP.
I'll come to that later.
Yeah.
When you were at the battery HQ, what would your typical day be like? What would you be doing?
Well, you did a stint on the radio, on the wireless set, these new 19 sets that we got. But it was there was a two-way thing. One, you kept in touch on one net to the OPs, and the other net was back to, I think it was Brigade HQ. No, it wasn't. Sorry, it was Regimental HQ. Yeah, they were through to Brigade HQ. So there was a sort of a radio link as well as a telephone link. The telephone wires were frequently cut, so you know it wasn't quite a cushy. It wasn't an easy job. You had to be on, ready to man the radio, and to.
Who would repair the lines?
Oh, the linesman. The signalers, the signalling team, if you like, were one. We were all sort of mates, but we had people who were ostensibly linesmen and people who were wireless operators.
You were a wireless operator.
I was a wireless operator. Yeah.
So you wouldn't be expected to go out.
I have done. I have laid lines. Yeah, because the armoured observation vehicles, as they were called, the armoured OPs, they had a bracket with a reel of wire on each wing at the front, and we could, in an emergency, run a line out with one of those.
But not often.
But
you didn't repair.
Sometimes, yes. If there are two of us on the radio, one of us could go down the line as far as until we met the linesman. The linesman used to be coming up and down with a thing called a crook stick, which is just a long pole with a hook on the end. And they used to sort of come up the line with that rather drearily. Again, I've got some drawings of them too. I think they're in that showcase in the exhibition at the moment. And eventually they'd have no line in there and they realised it was cut. And then they might have to go searching for quite a long way, because if there'd been a bit of a stonk on that line, they'd have to search. And then they might find half a dozen lines, and you didn't know whether they were going to the bloody Gurkha position or the Essex or wherever. And very often, from then on, they'd connect up using sort of reef knots and insulation tape, and you'd then sort of run a new line up to the OP. Well, it wasn't too far. But there was the M trucks, M monkey, we used to call them. Now they call them Mike 1, don't they? But it was Mike 1 and Mike 2. They were maintenance trucks, and they had a big reel of wire, a huge reel of wire in the back. And one of those would run it up if it was safe enough to do that. Otherwise, it would have to be run up by hand with a hand reel.
And what sort of messages would you be getting when you were at command post? What sort of was it, routine messages?
There were routine messages from regimental HQ. They weren't coded. Well, yes, to some extent they were. There's no giveaway of positions, but I didn't take particularly much interest. I mean, I just wrote down what was coming through. Sometimes it had to come through on Morse, because there was an awful lot of mush and static and jamming. The Germans had a very good jamming station. It sounded like barrel organs playing. It seemed to be on every frequency sometimes. And you'd have to sort of get through with Morse on top of that. So it was, very often coded, five-letter coded stuff. You had message pads which were divided, which held five-letter groups. Yeah, I remember now that they were coded, a lot of the things.
And would you decode them, or would that be someone else?
No, my job was just to write them down.
Just meaningless?
Meaningless stuff, yeah.
And how long would a stint be on?
Well, you do a sort of 12-hour stint, usually, on the radio. And then, most of the time, looking back, my sort of hazy memory is it was quite a lazy period. People would be sitting around in a little group playing brag. I'd be drawing. Again, there's another drawing I've done of a card school, squatting around in the sand, and I actually drew them, feeling sort of not excluded, but I didn't play cards anymore. I used to lose a lot of money at pontoon, and I stopped doing that. People read. The books had come out in comfort parcels, old penguins and things, and I remember reading quite a lot of stuff at that time.
What was your food like? How did the food come up?
Well, the food was cooked in the wagon lines, and it was brought up in a three-tonner, usually in these Dixies. It was cooked in horrible sort of petrol blowers, which probably caused quite a lot of fatality. Well, bad accidents anyway, if not fatalities. These things would blow up sometimes because they were using petrol, and the blower was like, they were like flamethrowers, about a 6-inch nozzle on these things, and you put a row of Dixies into this steel container, and then you blow this thing through, you see. And the cooks would go around staring whatever was in the Dixie. They weren't very good. They certainly weren't chefs by any means, and so a lot of the food was complete mush. You know, whatever they had going, whether it was tinned sort of beans or McConaughey's stew. That was the favourite, McConaughey's.
You like that, or they liked that?
That was awful. That was easy. See, they'd open these tins of M&V, meat and veg, McConaughey's. The big tins and the small tins. The small tins were five, a truck messing. But they opened these big tins, and then tins of potatoes. And dehydrated veg started coming in from America, I think. It was always a sort of stew. It was a nondescript stew, and it was all right. It was filling, but I mean, it wasn't exciting.
What about breakfast? Did you get anything?
Later on, we started getting tinned bacon from America, which was very fatty, but it was quite nice because we never had bacon before. And, you know, you could dip your biscuits in this hot fat, and You had a mess tin, and you got a dollop of bacon with a lot of fat in, and occasionally somebody would go down towards Alex and forage for eggs in places like Wadi Nathrun and places on the coast where the Arabs would swap eggs for cigarettes. And you'd come back with eggs, and you might have, and it was a big luxury on Sunday morning, you might have eggs and bacon. But basically, it was corned beef and M&V. And in the evenings, you'd still have the same old biscuits. I can't ever remember having bread. I've heard people talk about mobile bakeries. I never had any bread.
What were the biscuits like?
The biscuits were very hard. The Australian ones they tasted like dog biscuits. They were as hard as dog biscuits. And there were two sorts. One sort you could actually crack with your teeth, and we were all quite young with good teeth, so we could chew those. But the other sort, I think the Australian ones, were impossible. You had to break them with stones. You'd crack them between two stones and then leave them to soak overnight, and eventually they went soft, and you made a sort of burgoo, which is Hindi for porridge. And but that was sort of breakfast as well. And then in the evenings, you'd get pilchards and cheese. You know, sometimes, not often we got cheese, but sometimes we got cheese. But mostly it was pilchards and jam, awful jam, which came in big cans from Palestine.
So it was a very restricted diet. Did you?
It was a very, it was rough. And yet we thrived on it.
Mm. Did you get any supplements, ascorbic acid tablets or anything?
No, not that I remember. Nothing like that. No.
What about drink, water?
Water was, at that period, it was fairly rationed. It was salty, so the tea was always curdled. When you put evaporated milk into tea, it'd get curdled. Whether the salt was put in to replace the salt that we were losing through sweat, or whether it was coming from wells that had been contaminated by the sea or by the salt in the underground, or what, I don't know. But there seems to be the first fresh water I remember was up in the Medinine Hills on the way to Tunisia.
So a long time later.
That was much later, yeah. And that was real water, and we absolutely thrilled out of our minds.
Did you get enough water? You said it was rationed.
The water cart would come up, and you could fill up. A lot of us still had our canvas buckets from the horse days, which you used to carry on your saddle. And so you could fill up your canvas bucket, and you fill your water bottle, and you might be able to fill a petrol can. The jerry cans that we managed to sort of liberate... that they were real jerry cans, the ones that they were German cans, and they were 5-gallon things, which you could fill up if you were lucky, you know, between two or three of you. And if that was the case, if the water was plentiful, then you were all right. You were able to wash, but never bath really, because you may have a sponge down and get rid of the soreness between your crutch and that. You know, sometimes you get sweat rashes and prickly heat and so on, but basically no, there's no baths.
Were you expected to keep clean shaven, short hair?
We expected to shave, yeah. The long range desert group were allowed to grow beards, but we weren't, so we adjusted to it. I think it was in a way a good life, you know. Except when we got stonked, you know, and that was maybe a few days, perhaps. And these evenings would almost, not every evening, but pretty near every evening, the Stukas would come in, because they knew where we were, and drop bombs, which were pretty harmless most times. You know, usually about three or four Stukas would just come screaming down. And they were dive bombers, you know. And I think the object was to terrorise, but they didn't really succeed very much. We got used to them. The shelling was different, yeah. And
how frequent was that? That you was, say every few days.
Well, you get I think it depended on the mood of the Germans. They knew where we were, I suppose, and if they felt like giving us a pasting, they'd do it.
What about the latrines, or was there any latrine provision at all?
We eventually dug a deep hole. Normally, people would go off with a spade, leaving a good 50 yards from anybody else's position, and dig a hole and do it, and then fill it in like a cat. Eventually, some hygienic officer, decided we were going to have a battery command post, a train. And we dug this very deep hole, and we put planks across it. Oh, we put the ammunition boxes there where the soft sand was, and we put planks across, and we put a tin of some sort with a hole in it, anyway, to sit on. And people used to go and sit on this throne until one day it collapsed. And then we went back to the old system. It fell in. I don't think anybody fell in with it, but I mean, it did fall in. And that was the end of that attempt to sort of civilize us. Montgomery took over later on, and there were orders for PT, which was absolutely ridiculous. We had to sort of start doing PT in the sand, and jumping up and down with our arms waving. And
did that serve any useful purpose, do you think?
It irritated a lot of people, yeah. Because we were incredibly unfit, I think, at the time. We weren't exercising. We were lying around reading. And
so it annoyed people, but it was actually probably a sense.
I think we started to feel okay about it in the end, yeah.
Now, what about when you went up to the OP?
Yeah, we go up in the armoured observation vehicle, the armoured OP, and you'd get your own ration, your truck messing rations, which were better. You know, you'd sometimes get a tin of peaches and tins of bully pilchers and so on. But it meant that you could use a bit of imagination in how you used these, how you cooked, what you cooked. And I used to enjoy that because I love cooking, or still love cooking. Yeah.
So what sort of things would you use your imagination on? Well,
up at the Honey OP, where this tank was, did I mention that?
Yes.
The bodies that were in it, and eventually, I think they did eventually get them out because the smell went. I think the Pioneer Corps, somebody was able to cut it open. But I made an oven there, which was there all the time. I think other people may have used it, but it was with...
How did you do that?
Well, it was fed with wood and camel scrub underneath. It was just that there was a piece of steel that I'd found as the base of the oven, which is... I dug a hole in the ground, fitted this piece of steel in, and then one of these completely ubiquitous petrol cans... and a lid, another piece of steel for a door for that. And then I banked that over with wet sand until it was about 6 inches deep all around. And that was the oven. And we could put a mess tin full of wadge in there, like this porridge stuff that we'd make with the broken up biscuits. And dates, if we had any, or even tin peaches, or, you know, you'd mix anything with it, jam. And margarine. We had this stuff called oleo margarine, which was revolting stuff. And we'd mix it all together and put it in two or three mess tins. So we had two or three cakes would come out. So that was one thing. We made cakes. We made another thing. If we got eggs, we would make a sort of egg wodge with the same biscuits and the eggs. Different sorts of... things like sometimes we got flour issue. That was it. We had a tin of flour in the vehicle, and we could make like sort of rissoles with not rissoles, fritters with the corned beef. You make a crude sort of batter, and dip these slices of corned beef in it and fry them. So all the sort of things that the cooks down the wagon lines couldn't be bothered with. But as there was only four of you in the armed OP, then. It was good, yeah.